Red Script Studio presents The Trauma That Binds series, Part 4, A Conversation with Sheila Brill, a segment of Living Vicariously. Please note that this episode of The Trauma That Binds series may contain mature subject matter that could be triggering for some audience listeners, so listener discretion is advised. Hello, Podcast Nation, and welcome back to Living Vicariously for another episode of The Trauma That Binds series. Today, we have the honor of hosting Sheila Brill, author of Can I Speak to Josephine, Please? Sheila's book shares her personal journey and the challenges of raising a child affected by a catastrophic brain injury. So just one moment while I get Sheila on the phone, and then she'll share her experiences and the life she shared with Josephine. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how you doing?
Not too bad, my dear. Yourself?
Yeah, just coming in from the garden in the sunshine and coming back indoors.
Perfect. That sounds like a lovely day.
Yeah, it's actually very nice here. It's about, I don't know, 20, 21 degrees, which is, you know, civilized. Hang on a second, I'm going to change my glasses as well.
Yeah, no problem at all. Take your time. So, Sheila, you just got in from Portugal. How was Portugal?
Absolutely beautiful. It was lovely. We were on the coast. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny country. I didn't realize it's less than 2.5 times the size of the UK. You know, less than half the size of the UK. I mean, it's really small and it's all kind of mostly coastal and it's gorgeous. And we were staying in a lovely hotel. It was just very relaxing.
So this is for a vacation or did you do some book work while you were there promoting your book?
No, this was a much needed vacation from all the stuff related to the book. There's been so much and there's still more going on, you know, so we just needed to step away a few days.
Well, for sure. You definitely need that time to get away, readjust, and now you're back and you're on with me talking about the book.
Fine. That's great.
Perfect. So what? Yeah. So why don't you just share with our listeners what inspired you to write the memoir and how you chose that title?
The memoir didn't start as a memoir. So my daughter Josephine passed away on the 15th of January 2017, and two or three months later, I started going to this group, which was a writing for well-being group, and it was just a sort of safe space. Turned out it was all. I think it was all women, yeah, about 12 of us. And we just wrote about whatever we wanted to write about. And I started writing about other things. And then eventually I must have written something about Josephine. And it started from there, but there was no intention of writing a book. And sort of 7 years down the line, here the book is, you know, many iterations of it, you know, much editing, many people hearing bits of it, reading bits of it, commenting, and me sort of tearing my hair out and not always writing in a safe way, you know, because it was very emotionally draining. The title of the book is because when Josephine was 15, the landline in the house, so this is predating mobiles, predating cell phones. So the phone in the house rang and I picked it up and this young woman said, "Can I speak to Josephine, please?" And nobody had ever phoned to speak to Josephine, and nor would they, because she couldn't speak. She wouldn't understand. It was impossible.
Right.
So I was completely floored by it and sort of stuttered and said, "No, you can't." And they said, "Oh, sorry, can I phone back later?" And I said, "No, who are you?" And she said, "I'm phoning from Careers Guidance," which was a kind of organization that you know, helps young people into their careers. And nobody had told her that Josephine was profoundly disabled and that was never, ever going to happen. So it was pretty shocking for me to get that phone call. And as I wrote in the book, it also made me realize that nobody would ever phone to speak to Josephine for a social arrangement or anything. It would never happen. And, you know, it just wasn't a normal situation. And so it felt like it kind of encapsulated her situation, really. And that's why I chose the title.
That's beautiful, Sheila. I'm almost in tears hearing that. I love that. Now, being as deeply emotional draining as you said it was, how did you navigate the process of writing the book and sharing your details with the readers?
Well, I have a study which is next door to the kitchen, and I would sort of retreat in here to write. I did write pen to paper quite a bit, actually, which I felt helped connect me to the words more. The thing that I needed to learn, and I don't know if I ever really learned it, was how to conclude a writing session and go back into my life as it was then, rather than still living in the past as I came out of the room. So, you know, the family, my husband and my son, both experienced me still in distress from thinking about things and reliving things as I wrote about them. So, you know, my advice to anybody who's ever going to put any traumatic experience into writing is to have a way of coming to a stop when you've, you know, and then switching off and switching away from the process into your normal life or whatever that is, because otherwise it just kind of bleeds into everything, you know. I did go to a writing club and we shared our writing with one another, and people were very generous with me. And I was actually able to read aloud to a group of 20 people, and it was hard, but I did it. And I think that was part of my transition, part of my way of becoming a writer, actually. And I found that very helpful. I also had a writing mentor. I was supposed to go to a writing retreat in Scotland, and I was very excited about going to this. And then it was cancelled because there weren't enough people interested. So I said to the two people who were leading it, please, will you come to my house and do it here? And they did.
Wow.
And that was amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So we retreated into my study and all over the house, actually. And they helped me. They helped me formulate my words, think about what I was doing. Yeah. So that was part of the process. I think, again, my feelings about people embarking on something like this is it's not a solitary activity. Everybody around you is kind of part of it, and you need people to help you make a sense of your words, and people who are generous and people you're safe with. You know, you've got to pick your people very carefully. Let's put it that way.
Right. And bringing these trusted folks in were a big part of helping you cope and heal with this process of writing the book.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's perfect. And exactly, like you said, we just need to just be mindful of who we pick and choose, because sometimes, and I know in my own experiences, that their true intentions aren't always obviously known at the start until later on, and it can just become a huge mess, right?
It's a risky business. There's no question. It's a risky business. You need to be, above all, you need to be safe when you're doing this, because you're putting yourself out there. I mean, I've put myself out there. I have said many very personal things about myself. They're out there now. They're out there in the world, and I had to be prepared for people to read that stuff. And people judge you. People will always judge you. I mean, nobody said anything terrible to me, you know. You know, I've had no backlash, I'm pleased to say. But I do remember one friend saying, you're really going to write that? You know, you're really personal stuff. You're going to put that out there? I said, yeah. And they just kind of looked at me, and I thought, okay, I want to do this. You might not, but I do, you know.
Well, and exactly. Some people just don't quite understand that need or calling to get that story out there, right?
I mean, the funny thing is the first thing that people often say is, oh, that must have been cathartic. And I kind of want to punch them, because it wasn't cathartic at the beginning at all. But people make that assumption. They think, oh, yeah, that must really help the person. No, it only, I don't know when it started to help. I'm not actually sure when it started to help. You know, it's hard to say, really, but it did not start that way. It wasn't intended that way. And I learned, so I used a particular guide to writing memoir, and the most important thing that I learned was to understand what things were really about, because sometimes I could recall an episode in Josephine's life and think, why do I remember that? Why is it important? Why is it important enough to go in the book? What's this really, really about? And every time I asked that question, if I couldn't find the answer, I had to keep writing it until I did, because the significance of things, and it's funny, the things we remember, that just the ordinary stuff, it's not always the extraordinary, sometimes it's just the ordinary little things. But why are they important? Why do we remember them? And there's always a reason. There's always a significance, I find.
Well, and you're absolutely right. I find it's a kind of a version of organized chaos theory. It's a bunch of chaos, but there's just a reason and a rhyme for it.
Yes. I mean, there's one particularly shocking episode in the book where my daughter had a special hospital bed that had a program that rotated the mattress to stop pressure sores. And the mattress had a 30-degree turn. So it would be flat, and then you could set the program to last for 30 minutes or 60 minutes or whatever. And then it rotated to one side slightly by 30 degrees. And then it rotated back to the middle and then back to the other side. So, but you shouldn't slide off the mattress, but it allowed her to shift her weight in a way that stopped the pressure sores happening.
Right.
And the bed had bed sides to stop her falling out. And they were bars. It looked like wood, but it was actually something else altogether, which I can tell you about. And the bar had a space, the two bars had a space between them, and it was a very small space. And we had a CCTV over her bed so we could see her during the night, because she had seizures and things. And I woke during the night and she wasn't in the bed. I couldn't see her, so I ran downstairs, and her head was stuck between the bars. She had a very, very small head, and we didn't think it would fit through, but she got her head through, but she couldn't get it back. Oh. And the bed was rotating from to side. Yep. So we turned off the program and tried to calm her down, and we tried to get her head out. We couldn't. And so we actually filmed it to send to the bed company, because we thought they're never going to believe us. And then my husband had to saw the bedside, and it was fiberglass.
Oh,
so he got all cut. And she was in a mess. I mean, she didn't get covered in it, but she had a massive seizure, and she recovered and she was okay. But it was the most horrific experience. And I wrote about it, and I wrote the whole thing down. Why does it matter to put this story in the book? What is it about this, apart from the shock value? What is it about this that matters? And I realized that it was the only time in her whole life that we were able to save her without professionals stepping in and saying, you do it like this, you do it like that, don't do this, don't do that. We just did it. And we saved her life. And it was the only time. It was the only time we were ever able to do that for her. And that's what the significance of the story was. And it's that combing and combing and combing at the stuff, you know, working out, what is this about? Why does this story matter? Why does this bit in her life matter? Why did I need to write it? And that was the reason.
Wow, Sheila, that is, I honestly have no words for that. That's
exactly. You can't follow
right?
that one.
No, that's...
yeah.
Whew.
But the significance of it is, you know, it's that thing, that, you know, where many things. There was one chapter that I was advised not to put in, and I still am cheesed off about it because it was a funny chapter.
Okay.
And it was, I will release it. I will release it somewhere because I thought it was a brilliant chapter. I was very upset. It's about a caricaturist who tried to draw a picture of her. And you know how caricaturists work.
Okay, yeah.
You know, yeah. And he had nothing to work with because she didn't oblige, because she couldn't. And it's a great chapter. I love that chapter. It's gone out there somewhere in the world at some point.
Well, it sounds like it would be. And then once you get that out, you can probably redo your audiobook and add it to the new version, right?
Yes. Slip it in there.
Right?
Yes.
Just kind of whoop, put it in there.
Yeah. It's the thing about writing when somebody says, you know, you've written something, you think, oh, that's really well written. I'm really pleased with that. And somebody comes along and goes, nah, it doesn't add anything to the story. You think, really?
Well, I think when it comes to this type of subject matter, you need that kind of, let's say, comic relief in there to kind of ease that tension, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Right. You need a bit of comedy, because there's always dark comedy in there somewhere. There's always something.
Well, exactly.
Although, funnily enough, one bit of comedy which I did put in the book, my bereavement counsellor, when I told her this particular joke that somebody had made about Josephine. It was a parent with another child like Josephine. So it was kind of acceptable because of who he was. And I told my bereavement counsellor this joke and she just kind of frowned at me and said, "That's just deflection, Sheila." And I thought, sod off. I don't care if it's deflection, it's funny.
Well, right. And like sometimes you have those therapists or counselors that are like that. And then you have the ones that are complete opposite. But like, well, if the dark humor and stuff works for you to help cope, then that's great. But maybe we try work on getting a healthier coping mechanism type thing and they'll actually work with you. Right.
Yeah. That's fair.
So, yeah. So within the book, a very, very traumatic and hard story there, but also a very good message of hope, strength, and resilience. Now, when you were going through the writing this book, how did you and your family find the moments to keep on facing these challenges and push through to complete the book?
By the time I was writing it properly, I think it was probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 years after Josephine had died. And I wasn't really sharing it with them. They were getting, and when I say I wasn't sharing, I wasn't explicitly sharing it, but I was coming out of my study in a bit of a state, you know, in a bit of a mess. So they were getting I can't think of the right expression, the kind of end bits of it, as it were, but I wasn't sharing it. The difficulty, the big challenge was then saying to my son here, "You need to read this because you're in this book and you're named, number one. And number two, there's things in this that you might not want to have in there. And so you need to read this." And on top of that, you've got to remember that I was sharing my innermost thoughts with my son. Well, you don't do that with your kids. You know, it's not a thing that you do. You know, there's some things you tell your kids and there's some things why would you tell your child how you're feeling about something that's personal? You know, it's just not, I don't know. Anyway, so I had to hand him the book and my husband, and that was frankly terrifying, really terrifying. So my son read the book and said a number of things. He told me how proud he was of me. He also said he wished he'd known a lot of the stuff when Josephine was alive. He said, "There was so much I didn't know. Why didn't you tell me?" And he also, there were little things that he did as a small child that were kind of unkind things, but he was only a wee boy. And, you know, that's what kids do with their siblings. You know, they get irritated if they get too much attention, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And he said, "I feel so guilty. I feel so terrible." And I said, "Look, I'll take these things out of the book. They don't need to go in there." And he looked at me and he said, "No," he said, "you can't take them out. They happened, it's, you know, so that's the way it was." Okay. And then my husband read it and he was shocked in places. There was stuff he didn't know. There was stuff I said about his mother. I was very honest. And he said, "Yeah," he said, "everything you said was true. It was the way she was. It was just the way it was, you know." But I was quite, you know, I was really pretty honest. I didn't hold back. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So that was quite a thing for them. That was the hardest thing for me, to give the book to them and say, "Here, what do you think?" And then I gave it to my cousin Miriam Margulies, who then took the book away, read it, cried over it, laughed over it, and then wrote a beautiful foreword for it.
Right. Yes, I did.
And then recorded
that.
Yeah, I mean, that was just amazing. And she recorded it as well for the audiobook, which of course was fabulous.
Oh, did she record that bit for it as well?
Yes.
Oh,
it's in the
okay.
audiobook and her voice and her beautiful tones. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's just fabulous. Heard your voice, my dear. And again, it was very passionate and lovely.
Yeah. Well, if you look at my website, there's her foreword is there.
Right.
With her reading it. And there's some footage to go with it. Yeah. The process of reading the audio for the audiobook. Wow. Oh, God. Where do I even start?
Right.
So, we use my study, which is not a proper recording studio. We had a sort of kind of encasing for a really good microphone. And we used Audacity, I think it was.
Yep.
It was Audacity. So it's 9 hours of narration, but I don't know, how many hours of work in total, 40 hours maybe, I don't know. You know all about this stuff, don't you?
Yes. Well, and that's why I posted that one thing you commented on, because that's one of the things I like to explain to the clients who are looking to get into audio, get an audiobook done, because when they choose a per-finished hour rate, all they see is that bottom number. They don't have it break down and understand the work that goes into it. So I find breaking it down builds that rapport. But you're right. My first audiobook was a complete reality check to how excruciating narrating can be.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, so, and if you're in a professional studio, you don't have a truck driving past. We live in a corner of two roads, so you'd have cars starting up, you know, driving off, you know, the doorbell would ring, or, you know, all sorts of things. So all that sort of thing. And then, of course, we had we have what we call a Velux window, which is a window in the roof,
right
above in my study.
Okay.
So when it decided to start raining, that was the end of recording.
Oh, no.
So, you know, the sort of things in a professional studio that don't matter,
yep.
We had them as well. And then, then there's this sort of, in my head, nobody was going to narrate my book for me. Nobody. That was not happening. You know, I knew I had a good enough reading voice, but I also had to work out, you know, do I orchestrate the emotion, or do I let the emotion happen naturally? How much in control of my emotion do I need to be? How do I do the internal monologue? How do I change it so it's obviously not me speaking aloud? There were so many questions. I didn't prep the manuscript because I felt as if it was overprepared, I wouldn't be able to read it naturally. But then there were times when, you know, Peter, as editor, said, no, you need to emphasize this or that, whatever, you know. So we had to go back to something. And there were chapters that were emotionally very, very hard, and some in close succession, so that was tough. We didn't realise we had to do it chapter by chapter, so we had to have a space book, a silence before the chapter name, a silence after the chapter. You know, we learned on our feet.
Right.
We really did. I mean, it was a great experience at the same time, because actually, I had a great feeling about my writing. I realized I could write well when I read it. And when I listened back, I could listen to myself quite happily. And yep, that's okay. And that was a good feeling.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's definitely a good feeling when you can just actually listen to what you write and actually be pleased with it.
There's a lot of work in creating from a blank page and then getting it onto a good sound. And yes, there's a lot. I do other stuff. I write sort of comedy stuff. I was just listening to one of my pieces earlier. It's a 2-minute piece. I had a hip replacement in November 2022, and I had to learn how to get dressed using what we call here a grabber,
right?
Which is one of these things that you pick things up from the floor without bending down.
Yeah.
It's got a kind of handle that you squeeze and that you reach for something and you squeeze and you pick it up, and that includes things like panties and socks. And I wrote a piece about that. It's very funny. There's a lot of swearing in it.
Well, swearing's okay. Definitely good to get the frustrations out that way. And then you were also, before we even got on the phone there, you were working on some training material for your midwife program.
Yeah, it's a charity that, they're a wonderful charity, Baby Lifeline, they're called, and they work with midwives who are very experienced, and this is an advanced course in how to read baby heart traces during labor. And they wanted a video of me talking about my experience, because, you know, these are men and women, mainly women, who don't have experience of hearing about the survivor's story, the survivors of birth trauma. It's not a much heard story, let's put it that way.
Right.
And so, you know, hopefully they'll get to listen to it and hopefully buy the book. That's the aim from my point of view. But the aim is to also, you know, really to help them understand the consequences of birth trauma, you know, the lived consequences of birth trauma.
And is this one of the ways that you kind of work towards advocating for some of these overlooked aspects of raising a child with some injuries?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things that have happened. I've done co-interviewing for candidates for the midwifery degree, also for the nurse's degree. I've done some teaching about communication to adult nursing students. I'm going to a family conference for a charity that supported the book, talking about, you know, disability and families and how one manages or doesn't, you know, just the whole kind of honesty side of things. Because I think the story I tell is, sadly, it's a universal story for parents in this situation. But then most people don't write about it. They just live it quietly behind closed doors, you know. But I'm also... I've given the book to a member of parliament who has started an all-party parliamentary inquiry into birth trauma. That's about to report, and she's going to read the book. The president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says every obstetrician should read the book.
Wow.
And I'm trying to get her to make that happen.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The head of the Midwives College, I'm having a meeting with her as well to see what we can do. I'm trying to get it into universities as a reader for students. We're going to be working with Leeds University Medical School on communications. So it's kind of, I'm going from the kind of training the people at the start of their careers to people already in their careers. I'm trying to get my head around Twitter. It's doing my head in.
I can't do Twitter either, so don't worry about that.
Oh, God, it's just, I mean, I've gone from having about 40 followers now to having 130 or something, but that's nothing. That is literally nothing. But I'm just trying to get out there more and more because it's the only way to... It's kind of having an impact that I didn't expect. I thought I was writing the book for family and friends to read. That's the honest truth. That's what I thought I was doing. And now it's sort of become something else. And I have to really push for that something else to happen, to see change happen, because this is what happens if things go wrong, basically.
Well, exactly. And like you said, not enough people that go through it are talking about it or writing it down or letting people know. And so it's great that you're getting this message out there, even though how hard it's been for you. But you get what you put into it, or you get out what you put into it, and you have put into it a lot. And I can tell that, and it's absolutely great. Now, because I was going to ask how you hope to your work will contribute to raising further awareness, but you've already answered that. I didn't even have to ask. That's awesome, because you're trying to get that into the universities for people to read. And that's amazing, Sheila. That's great.
I mean, these youngsters at university are the leaders of the future, you know. And so if a book has an impact, you know, when you read a book yourself and it has a lasting impact on you, and it kind of informs some of the way you live your life afterwards, possibly. It might be just one small thing in a book you think, that means something to me, that speaks to me. And if my book can do that for a few professionals, you know, people who are going into the profession and think, God, I'll never forget that book, and I have to be on my best game in my profession, because otherwise that book will come back to haunt me. If that's the impact it has, then that will have made a difference. You know, I mean, we brought a case of medical negligence for Josephine. And when we went before the judge in the High Court, he said, I've heard this story so many times. And we just looked at each other and thought, oh, God, we thought this was going to make a difference. And it wasn't going to make any difference, not to anyone else. And, you know, the reports that we read about maternity disasters are shocking, really shocking. And the people covering up for things they've done wrong and management not being accountable. It's just unbelievably awful. We didn't realize it was that bad until we started. So our lawyers, they did the launch, the big book launch in London for me. And they, you know, they were telling us about all these cases, and it just keeps going on.
And no one knows about it until now.
Well, that's it. You only know about it if, God forbid, it happens to you, or it happens to somebody you know, or somebody you care about, and then you know about it. Otherwise, no. It's one of these things.
So being as this is something that really isn't known about, what are some practical ways that communities and individuals can get this message out there?
Well, I think it's the duty for professionals to get it out there. But I think, sadly, there is, it's a funny word to use, but there is a responsibility for pregnant women and their families to make sure they have agency in what happens at the birth, that they don't just go in thinking I'll be all right and I can trust these people. And it's having to say to people, don't trust what's in front of you. Shout loud, make sure you get what you should have, understand what can go wrong. And I think it's a very, very hard message to deliver to women and their families. Very hard message, because who wants to scare somebody, you know? But that's what, inevitably, that's what it does, is it's, you know, to actually say there's risk here, and in some cases, greater risk than others. And, you know, even having to think, do I want to give birth in that hospital when I've heard so many bad things about it? You know, to even have to think that way is horrendous in the 21st century. But I'm afraid women need to know, and they need to have agency. They need to feel they can say, I'm not happy with this. Listen to me. This isn't right. That's part of the job that has to be done. It's not enough to try and change the professions and make them safer and better staffed and better management and better decisions. It also falls to the women and their families to say, this is not good enough. I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not happy with this, you know?
Absolutely right. Like, even with my own son's pregnancies, they gave us the typical warnings and this, that, the other thing, but that was pretty much it. They don't go into any detail of what could possibly happen, what could go wrong. They just give you a sign-in sheet and like a waiver form, and then you have your child, basically. And then once you have your child, if something, God forbid, happens, then you have to deal with it then and there. And they obviously do try to put every safety in place before, but things unfortunately do happen.
I mean, there are things that, you know, unavoidable things, and they're awful, but it's the avoidable stuff that is so distressing. It's distressing to read. I had to read it because I was writing an article for the Midwifery Journal, which is a professional journal, and I had to read a couple of big reports about maternity scandals, and it was horrific reading. And it was about women often not being listened to. You know, and I wasn't listened to at the time, and I didn't know that I should have been better listened to. I didn't know, you know. And, you know, it is being aware, and, you know, yeah, it's being an advocate for yourself. It's, as I say, having agency in the situation and speaking loud and being demanding, actually. Being demanding. It's not an unreasonable thing to do.
No, it really isn't. And how I kind of think of it is I always tell when people ask me about how I started or found my voice type of thing, and to speak out about my own personal experiences with trauma. And it's just, I always remember this part from The King's Speech, the movie. And it was the therapist talking with the president, or the prime minister, sorry. And he was just going off and off, and then he was trying to just, the therapist was goading the president, and then he's just like, finally, I have a voice. And the therapist is like, yes, you do, and it's a very lovely voice. But it's just trying to get that voice out there is the only thing and heard, right?
Yes. And there's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of complaining going on in the world, a lot of complaining. This is one of many complaints about our particular health service as well, about the NHS, the National Health Service here in the UK. You know, everybody's got something to say about it. And it's very tough at the moment. It's tough all around. But it just feels as if the thing that's gone missing in all of it is listening, proper listening to people. And it's hard. Some people find it very hard to have a voice. They don't necessarily have the right words for it. They may not have the language skills. They may have other, you know, issues. They may be disability. There can be all sorts of reasons why finding your voice is a challenge. And I know that when I say women should have advocacy and they should have agency and all that, it's all very well me saying that, but it's not that straightforward for many women. It really isn't. And so it's the duty of the professionals to really listen and to hear what's being said and act on what's being said feels really important.
You're absolutely right. That definitely is important. And you're right. You can only say so much and advocate, but it's one thing to say it and it's another to do it, right?
It's not easy.
No.
And of course, in the face of professionals, but you know, it's quite funny. I was at an event at the university here, and it was looking at qualifications for what we call district nurses. These are nurses in the community. And we were in a room. There were several of us sitting around huge tables in this room, but there were also people online. And this woman appeared online and she was wearing a district nurse's uniform, which was a navy blue uniform with a kind of very thin white stripe on the kind of down the arm. And she, as soon as I saw this woman on the screen, and she had a particularly kind of nice face as well, a sort of comforting face. But as soon as I saw that uniform, I kind of could feel myself inwardly thinking, oh, I can trust you. There was just something about that. You know, it was the sort of person that rings your doorbell and comes in with a bag of things to make you feel better, and they're really nice to you. There was just that whole aura about her, and it was the uniform. And I just thought, wow, the impact. And so if I feel that way looking at this woman on screen in this particular context as well, you know, for some people, seeing a person in a particular uniform might make them feel safe, might feel intimidated. I can't say anything to this person. I can't say to this person, listen to me, you're not listening to me. You know, that's a big deal. You know, the way somebody appears to you.
The appearance of someone can be either intimidating or it could be comforting. And I know, like, especially with, let's say, policing, their uniforms are all the same, but it just depends on the person inside them, right? They're called bobbies over there, right?
well, not really.
Not called anymore?
Other things, not nice things. That's more of an old-fashioned expression.
Oh, that's good stuff. So finally, we're kind of getting close to our end of the session here, Sheila. I'm kind of sad to say it's been wonderful talking with you. So how about you let our listeners know where we can find some more information about you and your book, Can I Speak to Josephine, Please?
Well, the book is available online. So, and in fact, I think I've made one or two sales in Canada already. So it's available on Amazon, and it's available as a paperback. Can I Speak to Josephine, Please, is the way to find it. It's available as a paperback. It's available as an ebook, and it's available as an audiobook, either through Amazon or there's many, many other distributors that have the audiobook available. Kobo, Apple, you know, you name it, people I've never heard of are selling it as an audiobook. I also have a website, which is www.resilient-books.co.uk. And there's a lot of stuff on there, some stuff that I've written that's been put out in the media. There's some reviews on there. There is a recording of Miriam Margolyes reading some of her foreword with some images of Josephine. There's quite a lot there, really. And I should be adding more to it.
Perfect. That's great. I'm glad you've got so much to get our listeners to get to your book there. You got your website. You got your book on basically every single platform you can, and that's great. And for our listeners, it's like she said, it's available on Audible. It's very lovely. You get a copy, please. You'll support Sheila. You'll support Josephine in a huge, huge way. And as you just heard, you'll support the university students as well so we can get that information out there.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Perfect. I love it. So, Sheila, thank you so much for coming on today. I know we had some schedule to work out, especially getting back from Portugal there. But yeah, no, this has been great. I needed this. I'm sure you needed this as well to talk, get this information out there for folks. So now I can work on editing and get it out and published for you so that way we can get your message and Josephine out there to the rest of the world.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Oh, you're very welcome, Sheila. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon, okay? And that was the very lovely Sheila Brill, everybody. Be sure to check out Sheila's book, Can I Speak to Josephine, Please? For a raw and honest portrayal of trauma, resilience, and the power of personal storytelling, Sheila's book surely hits the mark. This has been the Trauma That Binds series, a conversation with Sheila Brill, a segment of Living Vicariously. Production copyright 2024 by Tim Douglas of Red Script Studios. For updates on studio productions, follow us on Facebook. Or if you have a story you would like shared, contact us through email at redscriptstudios@gmail.com. We'd love to connect. Until next time.